So welcome to today's podcast. I am delighted to be a guest of Mary Murphy here in Maynooth College this morning. A very quiet and leafy college campus you guys have in the middle of the summertime. So just about getting ready to go back in September. So we're going to be discussing the life of the work of André Gunder Frank, which is one of the 16 key thinkers on the Politics and Society course. But I'm absolutely delighted to have yourself, Mary, on board today. So thank you very much for taking part.
Thanks for asking. Yeah.
So if you don't mind, I'm just going to give a little bit of a rundown about your academic career and kind of your areas of academic interest.
Sure.
Okay? So you completed a BA in Economics and Sociology in Trinity College Dublin in 1986. And then you, for 15 years, I suppose, after that, you worked as a campaigner and a policy analyst, and you worked with several NGOs, so non-governmental organisations. And then you returned to education to do your PhD in politics from Dublin City University, and you graduated in 2006.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And your interests academically are public policy, social security, power and civil society, and gender. You hold a number of prestigious roles. So currently you coordinate the Bachelor of Arts in Politics and Active Citizenship here in Maynooth. You are also the lead investigator on a Horizon 2020 project. And you are a member of the National Advisory, or were a member of the National Expert Advisory on Taxation and Social Welfare. And you are also currently a member of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission.
Yeah.
That is pretty impressive.
All of the above. Well, yeah.
So you're clearly a very busy lady. On top of that, you have written 3 books, God knows how many reports, and about 1 million papers at this stage. And I actually met you, I guess, a few moons ago now when I was doing my master's. And we met through another member of the department here, Rory Hearn, who had organised a conference here in Maynooth. And you very kindly supplied me with some of your own work, some papers that you had written for that conference. So thank you very much. It's lovely to reconnect with you. And have you on the podcast today.
Great, and it's great to see that you're continuing with your own work as well.
So before we kind of get stuck into the work of André Gunder Frank, I'm really interested for our listeners to hear about your experience of academia and how you got into the position, like how your life kind of helped shape you into this current situation that you're in now at the moment. So could you tell us a little bit about
your background? Yeah, sure. I suppose I was born and raised in Coolock. My father was a fireman. My mother was a stay-at-home mother. And I suppose I was always interested, looking back in it, in social change. I think growing up in Coolock gave you the opportunity to see some of how society's injustices worked out in real life.
So Coolock, I'm thinking about in the 1980s when you were doing your BA, like Ireland was a very different place.
It was a different place.
I actually grew up in Bonoke in Clondalkin, which would have been a very similar kind of area to Coolock at that time.
Yeah, you're talking about places that there would have been a lot of local authority social housing built in the 1970s and 1980s. Very working class areas, but in the early 1980s you're talking about places that were decimated by unemployment as well,
because of course there was a huge recession and
a huge wave
of emigration then as a result of that recession.
Yeah, you had the oil crisis and then you had like a lot of emigration, so that was the context in which I was forming my own opinions, and I suppose I was very interested in there has to be a better way of organising the world. Well, as a starting point in thinking about it.
So you're an organisationalist.
Well, I was interested in making the world a better place at a very basic level. And I suppose when I was 16, 17, I thought that maybe you do that through doing social work and things like that. But when I went into college, I went to Trinity College, maybe thinking I might do social work or something like that. And I began to realise much more clearly that the world was very structurally uneven and that fixing individual people certainly wasn't the way to make it better, that it had to be a structural policy approach
bigger
to
picture.
Changing the world. It had to be about social change. So I switched kind of from thinking about a social work kind of orientation.
Can I even just ask about your entry into college and things like that? Like, so as you said, you're coming from a kind of a working class area. Would it have been unusual for people from Coolock at that stage to be in Trinity College? Because I know Joe Duffy speaks about coming from Ballyfermot, so that was a very working class area, and he went to Trinity College, I believe. And just kind of you know, was that unusual for you? Were your friends going to college at the time?
No, most friends didn't. I suppose from maybe the 150 students who would have been in my sixth class doing the Leaving Cert, the main trajectories, if anybody was going to college at all, I suppose some people went into primary school teaching and some people went into nursing, some people went into maybe to secondary school teaching, but that was the more typical of those who were going to college. Very few went in a vaguer way to do arts or to do subjects like sociology. So, for example, I had never heard of the word sociology.
That's what I was going to ask. Because yeah, I've never heard about it. Before this subject, politics and society, there might be a whole load of young people out there who haven't really been exposed to sociology or politics before. So they wouldn't really be thinking going into to college. And it really kind of is your one chance at free, a four-year degree, free education as such, you know, and to miss out on that opportunity. I mean, I wish, I'm a teacher myself, you know, and I would love to have had the opportunity to have really gotten into politics.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so jealous of the politics and society Leaving Cert syllabus, because had I had that when I was 16, 17, I would have eaten it.
Yes.
I would have loved it. It was the thing that I knew was out there somewhere, but that you couldn't find. So I think much more students now will be opened up to the idea of studying politics, sociology, and broadly those kind of subjects. Because when I went into Trinity, I genuinely didn't know what sociology was.
So how did you end up taking the degree in sociology?
Because I went in to do a very broad subject called economics and social studies. And within that, there was an option called sociology. So I ended up actually doing a joint honours in economics and sociology, which totally surprised everybody. And it's funny, even at my graduation, my dad was a fireman. And I had always wanted to be a history and geography teacher until I was about 15. And somehow or other, he genuinely thought that I was still going to be a history and geography teacher, even at my graduation with economics and sociology. So we came a long way. But from there, I was still wanted to change the world. So I was very keen to get a job that could help me change the world, if you like. But I quickly began being employed in organisations that were about housing rights, Threshold, for example, or gender, the Well Woman Centre.
Can I just ask, were those organisations, so when you finished your BA in 1986, was it? So were those organisations were up and running at that stage?
They were early in their formation.
So it must be so interesting for you to see just those two organisations that you mentioned now. So the Well Woman Clinic and everything that's happened in terms of the last referendum on the repeal of the Eighth Amendment.
Yeah.
And then, of course, everything that's happening at the moment with the housing.
Well, I'll give you just one really good example. And it's a positive example, and it's where I retain my optimism about social change. Is like when I started in Threshold, it was probably 1988. And the training was very quick because you were being trained in about housing rights so that you could advise tenants in private rented housing about what their rights were. But there were very, very few rights, and the training was over almost as soon as it started because there was very little to be trained up in. Now, over that 30-year period, there has actually been quite an advancement in the range of housing rights that private sector tenants have. There's still a long way to go, don't get me wrong, but there actually has been quite a lot of incremental change over that 30 years. And if you take the Well Woman example, of course, this last year we've seen a pinnacle of achieving a massive amount of reproductive rights for women. So to some degree, I think that's one of the things when you're thinking, sometimes change looks as if it's very slow to happen. But if you look at it over decades, and particularly if you look at it over quarter centuries, you can see much more clearly that change does happen. And you can also see it doesn't happen without very, very hard work.
Yes.
Sometimes very hard, publicly obvious work like a referendum campaign, but more often just very slow, steady,
and consistent.
Campaigning
it's
work.
That consistency.
Yeah, having a very long-term aim
about
to change
freedom.
Things.
Actually, with Dimna Devine, last week I spoke about freedom and, you know, why don't more people kind of insist on it? And it's because it takes that constant maintaining. You have to fight for it. You know, the same with your rights, I suppose, to a certain extent. There has to be people who are consistently putting that pressure on. It's not just a one overnight revolution.
Not at all. And that's why like the degree that we teach here in Maynooth University is called Politics and Active Citizenship. So we're as interested in power from below. Like we're really interested in that politics isn't just about the politicians that you elect once every 4 years to represent you. We insist that politics is about participation, about deliberation, about you as the citizen at the centre of the political system and making that work and making the world change and being part of that change yourself, which gets you into very different places. It gets you into studying social movements, civil society, and the role of individuals in change, which is really interesting. And I think much more important if we look at the breakdown of political systems now, and we see the crisis, we see populism, we see Brexit, we see Trump. I think it's a really interesting time now to try and reimagine, well, what does politics need to be if it's to work in the future? It can't just be about representative politics because
and
we see it's in crisis.
And imagine, where is it going? If this is where it's come from now, how can this deteriorate?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, and of course, imagine how could it get better? Of course,
you
know, that's the job of your students, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's the way I I suppose Gramsci says it's like the old is dead, but the new is not yet born. So mm-hmm. we're in the process of actually reimagining what it will be like. There's experiments happening, there's pilots happening. And in a way, people are beginning to try and, you know, make a new type of politics in response to the crisis of the old type of politics.
Yes.
And I think, again, you need to keep a long-term fix on that. That won't happen tomorrow. It won't happen in five years' time. It'll happen over a 50-year period, probably.
So it's
trying to see that change as it's happening and understand it. I think that's the job of social science now and academics now.
I'm not
sure we do a great job at it sometimes, though.
You're still chipping away, and that's what the most important thing is. So, yeah, so to get back to André Gunder Frank. So he's the subject of today's podcast, and he is a German-American sociologist and economic historian who unfortunately passed away in 2005. So he... had his own life story, I suppose, shaped his academic career too. So he was a Jewish person. His family fled Germany when Adolf Hitler became the chancellor there, and they ended up in the United States of America. So he did a PhD at the University of Chicago, supervised by Milton Friedman, the Nobel Economic Science Prize winner, of course. And there was a kind of bit of controversy, I suppose, between
they certainly weren't on the same page ideologically, that's for sure.
So we might kind of return to that and kind of discuss that a little bit in a while. Then he moved to Latin America in 1962. He was a professor of economics and sociology at the University of Chile before he had to flee. Economic and political unrest there. Similar to Paulo Freire, this seems to be a theme within Latin American, particularly academics at that time, where by academics, I suppose, were in an unusually political context. They were feared, I suppose.
They are, yes, and I was actually in Chile and Peru last year at a conference on political sociology, and there's such a legacy of the degree to which sociologists in particular, not only did they have to flee, but they were often a target of persecution and torture and death. You know, a number of sociologists were killed in both of those regimes, and you can see it now in the structure of sociology in both Peru and Chile, where there aren't very strong sociological departments, mainly because they got depleted and because their new breed of sociologist often still has to go abroad to find employment.
Yes.
And it really strikes you of the personal sacrifices that those academics made at that time. And it kind of puts Frank's world in some sort of perspective, because he was an academic, clearly, but he was also very much in his own eyes an activist, a member of a very large number of social movements, and that was as important to him, I think, as the academic legacy that he had. It was the fact that he tried to be part of making change as well as being the academic.
Yeah. So the reason I suppose that they have put him on to this course is because he was just so influential in the particular field that he was in. He produced over 1,000 publications, 40 books, and his area was political economy. So can you just explain for our listeners the concept of political economy? Okay. What exactly are we talking about when we discuss political economy?
Because it comes up interesting, actually, because Frank was incredibly influential, and to some degree you can't really talk about development theory or even maybe globalisation to some degree without going back to the beginning and thinking, well, where did Frank fit into that picture? But you don't find him an awful lot in the textbooks that we're using in universities now to teach globalisation. And I find that quite curious, that he's a founding father of a lot of this, but to some degree his work has been integrated into other people's theories a lot of the time. But I suppose political economy is how economics actually was understood 100 years ago, where it was a clear understanding that markets, if you like, the way the economy works, is very much a construction of politics. So you can't study the economy without studying politics. And that's where political economy comes from. It's that clear understanding that the role of the state in constructing the rules through which the market actually works in our everyday lives is very important, and that you can't understand one without the other. Mm-hmm. So nowadays we teach politics, we teach sociology, we teach economics, and those disciplines rarely actually even talk to each other in some respects. Back then they were integrated as subjects into political economy. Yeah. You get that still in some European universities as a way of thinking about political economy, but more often they're separated, which is a pity.
So the one of the main theories, I suppose, that Frank is well known for is dependency theory. So it's the idea that resources flow from a periphery of poor and underdeveloped states to a core of wealthy states, enriching them at the expense of the poorer ones. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of explain a little bit more about dependency theory and the importance of that?
Well, I mean, it is that idea that you have some countries that would be core. They would have an advantage in terms of a starting point. And through, as Frank saw it, through mainly coercive and exploitative ways, they begin to have a relationship of exploitation with what he called peripheral or satellite states. So whether it was through war or occupation, maybe it was through slavery. In more recent times, maybe it was through trade policy, through multinational corporations, or maybe even through aid policy, that they began to be able to take the resources from the periphery and use them to the advantage of the core country. And in that way, they limited the potential development of the peripheral country and increased the potential development of the core country. And that's the idea of uneven development. It's not that it's an accident to history or something like that. It actually happened almost on purpose that the core countries took from the developing countries and left them unable to develop and took away some of their people resources, their cultural resources, their natural resources in particular, and that this has been going on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose if you look at, say, for example, the UK, which he would have considered one of the core nations of this elite metropolis that he speaks about, like historically when they were creating their empire hundreds of years ago, they specifically sought out countries where they were resource rich. Mm-hmm. They wanted to go to a place and take natural... So if we look at places like... I don't know, maybe you could give us some examples. I'm just thinking about countries that have been colonised in the past. South Africa, you know, rich in diamonds.
Yeah. If you look at Latin America and the Spanish context, you know, when we look at some of the raw materials that they had, and particularly silver, for example, that would have been just sucked out, literally sucked out of a country. But we can also see it today, though. You know, if we look at the degree to which there's mineral extraction, again, in South Africa, in other African countries, and again in Latin America, we can see that mining, for example, is one of the principal ways through which natural resources are still being extracted from peripheral countries back into core economies. So Frank had this theory for a long time, and he argued that that process had been going on for a long time, for millennia really, rather than even centuries or decades. So that theory has been very, very influential. But Frank, in having that theory, was also open to some criticism. Some people would say, for example, that he exaggerated the degree to which it happened. Other people might have said he might have identified the problem, but he wasn't great at identifying the solution to the problem. Yes. Because,
and I guess a lot of academia is that, is it? You know, that in general, it tends to be a place where you're kind of looking at the problems, and oftentimes people don't feel like it's their place then to supply. Because it's you can come up with a lot of criticism if you supply a solution, right? That can be torn apart very easily.
And he did, and he was. I mean, he did try. And because he was activist and he was very orientated towards... he was very driven personally by a hatred of oppression and exploitation. And a lot of his motivation as an academic was about contributing to social movements that could stop that. So he was interested in solutions. But the type of solutions that he kind of identified, which were about trying to stop the capacity of the core countries to exploit the natural resources of the more dependent countries, were rejected by a lot of people as not being that practical, because there was a sense that you needed to integrate yourself into a world economic system if you were logically to be able to progress in that
globalised
world.
So this is the world systems theory that he speaks about, kind of the developed on from that. So could you tell us about what his understanding of where his theory was when he was discussing...
Okay, well, I suppose in the world systems theory, his idea was that the whole global planet operates as one system, and he was very keen to try and understand where individual countries and regions fitted into that country from the perspective of some of them being core countries in those regions and others being peripheral. But that the contribution he made to that theory was very popular, but he also then was in conflict with other world systems theorists, because some people believed the world was a combination of a number of different systems, whereas he believed that there was only one world and there was only one system in the world. So one of the really interesting things with Frank is that he got into arguments with virtually all major theorists that you can think of, from Karl Marx to Rostow's development theory to Wallerstein's world systems theory. He was well willing to get in and argue his case.
And that's wholeheartedly encouraged within academia, right? That's kind of your job as an academic. It's to look at things, observe what's not quite right, and then argue it. So half your job is to kind of be able to debate and discuss and propose good reasons why a current theory might be slightly wrong.
Absolutely. Now, there does seem to be something in the legacy of Frank where he managed to make a lot of enemies in the course of those arguments. He's said to have been a somewhat maybe cantankerous kind of character. And certainly there were very big ideological divisions as well in those kind of arguments. And he certainly was very clear where he was on that ideological divide. But he has clearly had an influence on the whole development of globalisation theory and dependency theories, and he clearly has a strong legacy. I think one of the really interesting things that you get brought out as well in a world systems theory is his later work again in Reorient, where he is accusing a lot of academic work and development theory work of being quite Eurocentric, and particularly maybe of being UK-centric in terms of putting the UK industrial revolution at the heart of how we understand the concept of development. And he is insisting that, you know, if you look at it, stand back and look at it over a much wider, longer time period, that you can see development through the eyes of maybe being Asian-centric, or from a world systems point of view, that Europe only has a quite small story to tell.
So he's looking at pattern.
He's looking particularly at global trade patterns over a very, very long period and trying to make sense of them.
He can see that there's a pattern over history where, oh, look, if this happens, then this is always going to follow.
Yeah.
So, for example, if there is a famine, does something happen consistently where somebody else comes in and tries to take advantage or exploit that country that's experienced famine?
Yeah.
So he's looking at that kind of much longer period to see what he can...
And of course, you can see more modern theorists thinking out some similar things. So Roderick, for example, disputes the modern focus on globalisation as being sort of new. He's saying, no, hang on, globalisation and these kind of global trade patterns have been here for centuries or for millennia. You see others like Naomi Klein, for example, and her idea of shock doctrine, similar, that when there is a natural calamity or indeed a man-made calamity, that you will always see people getting in to exploit that opportunity. And we hear, for example, in the last economic crisis, one of the most mantra kind of things that people were saying was, you know, there's opportunity in crisis. And that goes back to some of those ideas about that there are patterns there. There are patterns that when crisis happens, that there is always a core looking to exploit a periphery.
Well, Ireland, I suppose, is a country that has certainly experienced its fair share of crises over the last, even say, 200 years, for example. Just to put Frank's work into context, where would Ireland have stood? That, I mean, we've had an interesting kind of change in terms of, we were, like, he talks about peripheral countries and poorer countries, like, we were literally on the periphery of Europe. You know, we would have certainly been, like, Ireland was a very, very different place 100 years ago. Ireland was a very different place.
Is that...
So yes, we certainly experienced our fair share of crises, and just, you know, where would Ireland sit within this framework that Frank presents? You know, like we have changed, our position has kind of changed, hasn't it?
It has changed. I suppose Frank was always more interested in imperialism as a major force of exploitation.
Can you explain what imperialism means?
What I'll be talking about there is, again, the concept of a core country having a colonial relationship, taking over the actual rule of a more peripheral country. So, for example, Ireland was a colony of an imperial ruler, Britain, who also, in the context of the British Empire, had other peripheral countries under its jurisdiction. And Frank talks about that, you know, like even in some of the work before his death, he talked about Northern Ireland, for example, still being under the occupation of the Britain as its colonial ruler. So he was interested in his understanding of this core periphery idea, that imperialism predated capitalism. You know, so there were always countries through war or military occupation who had this imperialistic relationship with other countries and exploited them in that way. So I suppose Ireland fits that example very nicely in that it was always under the rule of an imperial power, and that stunted Ireland's development. It made it unevenly developed relative to where it stood in terms of its own natural resources and even its economic location. But the other thing that was important for Frank was location. He saw
geography.
That, yeah, geography, yeah. You know, and to some degree, so Ireland was peripheral in that it was an island behind an island on the edge of Europe. So we were peripheral in terms of location.
But then,
and Frank expected that had some logical explanation.
Due to political changes, our position, we changed from being this, not geographically peripheral, but a poor peripheral country. We changed when we joined, I suppose, the EU. That would have changed our position, according to Frank, would it?
It did change our position, and I suppose there's still a debate there to some degree about where Ireland does fit into a world economic system. I don't want to say a world systems theory, but if you try and understand where Ireland fits into a globalised world, you can say, okay, to some degree, we are a highly developed country now. We have used our new positioning geographically and otherwise to increase the level of development that we have. But if you look at it another way, we are still very much fitting into a world global system where our development, for example, is heavily dependent on the functioning of multinationals. So, for example, we're very much over-dependent, you might say, on foreign direct investment from multinational companies.
So we've got Facebook, eBay, Amazon,
exactly.
All these countries,
yeah,
that come into Ireland.
Which can be seen as a really good thing and as a cause of our development and our economic growth, but can also be seen as a sign of very significant vulnerability.
Because
so,
if they all just decided to
exactly.
leave. But it also puts us, I guess, in a position, when we talk about foreign direct investment, you can't escape taxation that goes along with that foreign. The reason why all of this foreign direct investment is here is because we're offering them a very lucrative deal in terms of very, very low taxes. And that could be changed.
Yeah.
I mean, the EU could say, if they wanted.
Absolutely. It leaves us very, very vulnerable in terms of development because, A, if you look at our own tax take, our own revenue that we get in to fund all our public services, 40% of that comes from 10 multinationals.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very, very dependent on them. That gives them a lot of political power,
yes,
in Ireland.
Yeah. So
and
that's
this
a great
is,
example,
yeah,
of political economy.
Yeah,
where
exactly.
the economy,
yeah,
and the politics is,
yeah,
relying on these 10,
yeah,
corporations.
Yeah.
You know?
And if we can see that in various ways, but one concrete example would be the power of the American Chamber of Commerce in Ireland as a lobby group is very, very significant. And that goes
so
back
a lobby
to the
group,
structural role,
yeah,
that those American companies, American-owned companies, are playing in the Irish economy and our dependency on them, for example, or our perceived dependency on them for things like employment. So that's one aspect of the vulnerability. But the other one is, as you just said, if those tax rules are forced to change in the context of us being members of the European Union or in the context of new developments in OECD countries and an agreement on tax coming out of that policy space, then our attractiveness to those companies may dwane somewhat. Now, it may not dwane totally because there's other ways that we're advantageous in terms of English speaking, high skilled, our geography, our access to EU markets.
Mm-hmm.
We've a lot of other advantages.
And I suppose our diaspora as well.
Our diaspora
us, yeah,
as well. And the cultural capital that,
mm-hmm,
Ireland brings with it,
mm-hmm,
at this stage. But the tax, we have marketed the tax very, very centrally as part of our own industrial policy to attract in foreign direct investment. So, you know, Frank wasn't necessarily talking about that when he started talking about how imperialism works, how it works through military occupation and through war. But he also advanced that work then into more contemporary times to see how it's done through multinational corporations, investment policies, it's done through trade policies, it's done through aid policies. So if you're bringing it up to date, I suppose the discussion of Ireland's tax policy fits very well into that logic.
Can we just talk a little bit about capitalism in general? Because although it's come up in so many of the podcasts I've done so far with the 16 key thinkers, we haven't actually really gotten into a kind of discussion of where it stemmed from and what exactly the basis and the failure. How did we shift? What was the shift towards capitalism? When was that era? When was the kind of major breakthrough of capitalism as such?
Well, I suppose, I mean, to my mind anyway, that one of the major breakthroughs towards capitalism would have been with the advent of the waged economy, when you began to see more and more of what humans did as activity began to be monetized, or being put, you know, money being put against it, and particularly waged labor. So the idea of capitalism particularly developed when we began to extract the value of a human's labor in terms of their work by paying them a wage and then keeping some of the surplus that they generated as profit. And to some degree, that's the start of what we can understand as the internal logic of capitalism, it being driven by the idea of taking from the worker the kind of profit that they were making, but also the degree to which money became a more fundamental medium of exchange in more and more of the markets that we had. So in the beginning, we had financial markets, we began to put a price on land, we began to put a price on labour, and generally we moved into a more moneyed kind of model of how an economy might work. And if you like, over time, we can trace the development of capitalism by seeing more and more how markets became the more fundamental way that we organised more and more of life. To the degree now that we are making up markets in money itself, we're making up markets more and more, for example, in ourselves, in our bodies, in we have a market for sport, we buy and sell sports people, we have a market for entertainment, we have a market for things that we never really thought we would have markets before. If we look at the idea of paying people, for example, for surrogacy, we have a market for social human reproduction beginning to emerge. Mm-hmm. So to my mind, the development of capitalism,
monetizing everything.
Yeah, it's about markets and about more and more things being monetized and being traded through markets rather than other forms of exchange that were more about reciprocal relationships at family level or tribal level or community level, where money didn't enter our means of cooperating with each other.
Bartering. Yeah. And
And so, I suppose at this stage of capitalism, what we have is this idea of, I suppose, a shift to a neoliberal form of capitalism happens when the market becomes more and more dominated and begins to crowd out the state.
So neoliberal meaning new and free. So free, we're talking about a free market.
We're talking about a type of capitalism, where the state backs off trying to make rules for those markets.
Yes.
So the idea of, if there were rules there, we take away the rules, we deregulate.
So, for example, the financial crisis that we had here in Ireland, the state stepped completely away. Yeah. Maybe there were regulations, but they maybe turned a blind eye to them, but, or they weren't particularly regulated very well. So they said that they would just let this be a free market, a liberal market when it came to banking in Ireland. And, of course, that had huge... Yeah. That's a great example of political economy, suppose, as well, is that that relationship between how a country works and the laws work, and everything is kind of... the social security of the people depending on the economy
of the country. And it's not just in Ireland. If we look at, take that very example of the rules we make for banking, after the Great Depression in 1929, there was again a lot of banks collapsed then as well, and the response was to bring in a lot of rules that regulated how banks were allowed to behave. And over the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you had a global system that regulated how banks
worked. So Sylvia Walby actually speaks a lot about this in her work, the cascading crisis. So we've done a podcast with her as well, and there was kind of this period of peace,
I suppose. A golden age of capitalism, some called it, but it was an age where the market was heavily ruled by the state.
Yes.
It was heavily regulated, not just the banking market, if you like, but the labour market
as well. So what happened then? Was it the 1970s? Was it the Reagan era, the Thatcherite era?
Yeah.
And what happened? What was the decision there? What was this massive shift then? What happened? Who made this change? Who flicked that switch?
Well, ironically, let's go back to Milton Friedman, who supervised Frank's thesis in the University of Chicago. So the University of Chicago had been a hotbed, if you like, of ideas. Obviously left and right at the time. We had Frank and we had Friedman. But Friedman was very much at the heart of a group of economists who had always harvested quite strong ideas about a deregulated market, a liberal, a very, very emphasis on a free economy.
Why? Because he felt that what?
Because they believed, I mean, they did genuinely believe that it was the most effective way. They believed that if you made too many rules, that you would stifle individual creativity, individual innovation, and the capacity of growth and
So basically competition he felt was a good thing because it led people to be more creative and that they felt that they were going to reap the rewards of their creativity, so they would actually go out there and do more. I guess it's the American dream kind of.
American dream. So those ideas were always there to some degree, but they were harboured and fostered and nurtured, if you like, by a group of economists, particularly led by Friedman. And when the oil crisis happened in the 1970s, those ideas were available, if you like, to think about, well, how can we think differently about how the world needs to be worked. So they were very smart and clever, if you like, about having a set of ideas ready when the world asked for an idea. They
which
were
is
there.
Actually
they
exactly what Frank talks about. Mm-hmm. When there is a crisis, somebody is, there's an opportunist there waiting, ready to come in and exploit that.
And opportunity. Friedman understood that. And maybe they talked about it in the context of the supervising relationship with Frank's thesis. But Friedman definitely understood the power of ideas and the need to be strategic and tactical about having your idea ready when the opportunity came.
So he was an activist of his own sort as well.
That. Yeah, no, very, very political. Understood the concept of political economy very, very well. And I suppose from that turn in, we see the advancement of that what we now call neoliberal economics, that idea that the market should be the primary vehicle and shouldn't be too encumbered with rules because it won't work properly if there's too many rules. We see that really begin to grow and grow and grow. And definitely the degree to which there weren't enough rules in the world economy definitely was one of the reasons for this later global crisis that happened in 2008.
So in the 1970s, what happened then that kind of flipped it back, that got rid of this golden era that you spoke about and Sylvie Wahlby speaks about as well?
Well, I mean, two big things happened, I suppose. One was the United States in particular brought in a series of new legislation that pulled out some of the old regulation that was regulating their banking system. And the second thing that happened was the breakdown of a system of rules through which the Bretton Woods Agreement, through which money was organised at a global level. And between those two sets of rules being pulled back, it opened up a lot of space for the market and new forms of maybe financial imperialism, I think is what Frank would see it as, began to rule the world to some degree. So we found that money got more powerful. Multinational actors who had a lot of money got more powerful. Global elites in finance began to grow, to the extent that at the start of this millennia and this century, we had probably what you would call a shift from even neoliberal capitalism to what we might call financialization. A time and a period in global capitalism when financial companies really began to rule the world economy, and to some degree the political economy. They had a lot of power in the world, and to some degree that power and the types of decisions they were made coincided with a massive increase in global inequalities, and to some degree that tipped the thing over and caused the crisis in capitalism, you might say.
Yes. Just to ask, in relation to all of these things that Frank very clearly observed. I mean, it's a huge daunting task. Imagine somebody said, look at the entire world and the entire history of the world in terms of its politics, its social issues and its economics, and try to see if you can see a series of patterns that are happening over and over and over again so that you can create a solution to those problems that keep cropping up over history and over the entire world. Mm-hmm. It's a hugely daunting thing. But my question is, there must be, you talk about how we are developing as a global society. We are becoming a better place, I suppose we're trying to. So what kind of mechanisms are there in place to try to prevent what Frank observed? So I'm thinking about like the UN, the United Nations, and various other global organisations like that. Are those organisations working to try to combat these problems that Frank observed? Or
potentially they are, but they're very weak relative to the scale of power that they're trying to combat or mitigate or regulate. I think if we look at things like even the UN Sustainable Development Goals as a concept or an idea, they clearly are an attempt to give another frame through which governments might make decisions about the allocation of resources and the types of legislation that they can make, but they have their work cut out for them to some degree if they're to be able to take on the power of global finance. So what a lot of people would believe...
Where does world power, like where, like we have the, in Europe, we have the Supreme Court, we have the Court of European Justice, the pinnacle so if something happens in Ireland that we feel is socially unjust, we can take it to further afield. And there's some kind of parent body who's going to put us in our place and kind of decide, you know, what's right and what's wrong.
But you see, we don't have that system to regulate the global economy at the moment.
But is it like the World Bank would be the most powerful thing? Does that kind of hold a lot of sway? IMF?
You have various processes. You have some that are more legal institutional, like the IMF or the World Bank. And they have certain types of powers. They have the power to lend money and to set conditions against the monies that they lend. So they have a lot of say in a country's development strategy and the types of policies that they might adjust. You have other spaces that are perhaps more political. You have the G20, the G7, G8. And those places are more political, but they are important in maybe opening up spaces for more political solutions to emerge. If you look at the idea of trying to manage global taxation, for example, you have some policy initiatives coming out of the European Union, which would be about, can you have a European Union policy on companies' corporation tax? You have some ideas coming out of the OECD on how do you manage to get global tax for these companies. But you also have ideas coming out of the G20. Now, what's missing to some degree is the institutional space at a global level that has enough power to bring those ideas together, to make rules and to have the power to implement those rules and hold multinational companies to account. I think we're at a very delicate stage in the world right now, because if we look at some of the attempts that there are by companies to really push for other kind of global institutions, if you like, that will not hold those companies to account as much. So we hear a lot about TTIP, the trade agreement that was being negotiated between the United States and the European Union. And if that had come to its natural conclusion, it would have brought into effect a series of institutional courts that would have been a new way of adjudicating when a state was in dispute with a multinational. But it wouldn't particularly have given a lot of power to the state. A lot of people feel it would have really reinforced the power of the multinational over the state and might have been quite a negative agreement. So right now, I think you're right. There are places in the world where we're trying to find new mechanisms like the Sustainable Development Goals or strengthening human rights institutions or developing new tax policies at the EU level or in the OECD. But all of them aren't yet powerful enough, I think, to really contain and control the power of financial capital that's really driving globalisation and that has such a power to influence any one country's development path. So I think we really need to double our activism, our social movements, our thinking, our ideas, to really try hard to come up with global level, institutional, legal, whatever kind of solutions can be brought about to really try and regulate the market,
so
to put it back in its box.
Kind of the task that lies ahead for this forthcoming generation of young academics coming into from politics and society, maybe, and it's certainly in a response to Frank's theories and his kind of main concerns in his own writing. So I think that's the perfect kind of way to finish up the podcast, you know, kind of a goal and a challenge to set for the next generation of political scientists and economists and sociologists indeed. If you had to give any little piece of advice for anybody out there who is considering a career, whether it be in academia or in within non-governmental organisations which you worked with, or working, liaising with government or consulting or anything like that as a result of doing a degree in politics or sociology or economics, what would your advice be to an upcoming budding academic?
I think it would be to read, which you might think, well, she would say that, wouldn't she? But I think it's to read outside of the curriculum that you're given by either your teacher in second level or your tutors and your lecturers in third level. These kind of, like, I'm really convinced the more I teach and the more I try and be involved in these debates, that the power of ideas is really influential in influencing what happens in the world, both to give us pathways to see how things might happen, but really ideas are what motivate and inspire us absolutely hugely. And we have no idea the degree to which what we think now gets influenced by ideas that we might have read 10 years ago or something like that, and that stayed at the back of our minds and sort of festered in our heads.
To not be afraid to have an alternative idea, not to be afraid to have an idea that challenges somebody else's status quo that has already been accepted.
No, absolutely. And to some degree, it's the absence of alternative ideas that I think is limiting the degree to which people are organising and mobilising for change, because to some degree you've got to have the ideas to motivate people to organise, and often the ideas come first. So I do think the production of ideas is really important. The, you know, the academic who doesn't seem to be doing a lot, but actually if they come up with one or two good strong ideas in a lifetime, that actually can be such a strong contribution to change in itself.
So read, be confident in your ideas, and put them out there. If you have good ideas, you know, and you're able to challenge somebody else's ideas, put them out there and don't be afraid to do it, you know.
But also, you know, don't be afraid to act on ideas. Don't be afraid to join social movements. Don't be afraid if you're annoyed about something happening. Find out other people that are annoyed with it. Talk to them. Do things. Get involved in the kind of local and national and global movements that are happening, because that's the only way change will come about at the end, is when people take the ideas and act on them to push institutions into changing. You got to have all three: the ideas, the interests acting on things, and then the spaces, the institutions, to bring the changes about.
Dr. Mary Murphy, it has been an absolute pleasure to be your guest here in Maynooth this afternoon. Thank you so much for taking part in the politics.
I enjoyed it, and thank you for inviting us. Thank you.